apologies from men accused or admitting to behavior that constitutes sexual abuse and abuse of power. Apologies from institutions that employ them. And even apologies from both men and women who knew that this behavior was occurring and didn't speak earlier. Apologies are only a beginning, a first step in a much deeper reflection, a process of self-reflection and societal reflection, and a process of reparations for unacceptable behavior. But apologies are a beginning. So I felt that I needed to start this sermon by telling you, and especially telling the women in this room, and also telling the people in this room who identify as LGBTQ in this room, that I am sorry. I am so sorry for the many ways, large and small, that you have suffered through abuse by men in positions of authority and power for so long. That abuse exists on a continuum that runs from criminal violence to what we've learned in our anti-racist training work to call microaggressions, small and subtle ways in which you have been physically or verbally assaulted or insulted or dismissed. That continuum is all connected, however, and none of it should be discounted as trivial. Let's be clear that the sexual abuse that is part of this continuum is not about sex, but about violence in service of power and about systemic ways in which this violence is condoned. I am sorry that this has been a part of your life and that it will continue to harm or threaten you, because let us not kid ourselves here, even though time's up and there is a public conversation and movement that is demanding an end to this kind of abuse, it's not going to just end like that. So today, as we begin this sermon, let us take a moment inside the sermon to enact a ritual that has been part of our worship services for over a year now, a ritual that we call a response to violence. Today, we want to dedicate our response to violence to all who have suffered the violence of sexual abuse. And I'll ask Denise if she would be willing to ring the bell for us as we pause. And we ring a bell and hear that bell in solidarity with all those who have suffered that violence. Solidarity. We pause and we ring because we are called to remember that the violence of sexual abuse has been happening not just in the lives of public figures or people in the military, but routinely, quietly, secretly in the lives of people all over the world. Remembrance. We pause and we listen because we are called to recommit ourselves to the work of upending sexual violence and serving the cause of love in our communities and beyond. Commitment. Now, I wanted to apologize to you personally today, not just to make a good rhetorical device to begin a sermon, but because I am complicit in this behavior and I should not say anything about it without taking personal responsibility. In all of the justice work we do in our church, and especially in our work on racist oppression, we have often said that it is important for people who want to be allies, who are part of the dominant group, to own their own personal responsibility and indeed to own the whole catastrophe, as my Zen teacher used to say. So at the moment, I am the man in this church who is standing in front of you at the big pulpit who has a lot of formal and informal authority and power. So even for that reason, I'm one person who should be extending a public apology. But I also want you to know that the Me Too movement and the ways that women in my life have responded to it has brought about a great deal of personal self-reflection about my own experience and behavior, behavior I have taken for granted and either excused or defended or forgotten, and occasionally apologized for in the past. And I have had to ask myself, have I ever engaged in non-consensual sexual behavior in which I was the aggressive or insisting party? And if I'm truly honest with you and with myself, the answer to that has to be, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't trust anymore my own memory or my own understanding of what was going on. I can't say, and I shouldn't say, not me or not all men in response to Me Too. All men need to accept the challenge of taking personal responsibility for what has happened and for ensuring it stops happening. And I will not pretend today that I can appreciate what it has taken, what kind of courage it has taken for the women who have publicly called out the behavior of men in powerful positions to step forward. What occasional experiences I have had of being the object of unwelcome sexual overtures or bullying are very few, but they are memorable, and even these few give me a little insight into what most women have experienced in smaller or larger ways routinely. But that's about all I think I have any right to say about the tsunami of painful stories that women in public life have been telling us these past few months. What I can talk about today with more integrity is male upbringing and behavior. It's behavior that I have come to understand as part of what we're calling today toxic masculinity. Poisonous and destructive male behavior that arises from long-standing, multiple generational beliefs about what it means to be a man. So before Christmas, a newer member of our congregation that I was talking to about church and things that he might like to get involved in church, Christian Straubauer Jones, began talking with me about toxic masculinity, about this service that we were planning some months ago, and Christian's own experience in attending and leading groups that encourage healthy masculinity. And we both agreed that if I wanted to do a service about the Me Too movement, it should be about masculinity, rather than trying to speak to women's experience. Having him involved as well, a person of a different generation than me and a different set of experiences would be valuable, that we should speak to our experiences and struggles as men, the consequences of toxic masculinity in our lives, as well as about ways that everybody can start working against the forces that create toxic masculinity. And I think it's a root reason why the Me Too movement exists. We also felt, as we talked about this service, that we needed to have women's voices involved, and not just in the way that Denise has been so gracious to be involved today, but in a service that is designed, led, and offered by women. And so there is a team of women that is gathering to speak to Me Too later in the spring. We're not sure about the schedule of this yet, from their own perspective. Our hope is that today's service invites personal reflection about your own life and relationships, and to extend the opportunity for your participation beyond listening to us. We have created two different conversation opportunities after this service ends. One for people who identify as men, one for people who identify as women. And each offers an opportunity within maybe an hour of conversation or for however long you want to go to share first reactions to this sermon, to share anything that you'd like that's come up for you in response to the Me Too movement. Christian is going to convene the group for people who identify as men, which is going to meet in the Jordan RE room, which is through that door, a left turn into a classroom, and another left turn into the adjacent classroom, and there's a sign on it that says Jordan RE room. And the women's group is going to be convened by a friend of our congregation, Sarah Keeley. Sarah, would you mind standing up wherever you are? Thank you. Sarah is a UU and a licensed professional counselor that has been involved in our congregation before. And thanks, Sarah. And the group for people who identify as women is going to meet in the high school youth room, which is again through that door and on the right side. I'm going to offer the first Sunday of the month usual inquirer's conversation in the minister's office over there after the service ends. And we can all get some coffee and make our way in there in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes after the service ends. But besides talking about Unitarian Universalism, and we're mainly going to do that in that group, if any of you who are visitors today want to talk a little bit more about this service in the context of anything that's come up for you, be glad to do that in the inquirer's conversation as well. So it's my belief that toxic male behavior exists on a continuum, and that men who don't feel that the Me Too movement is somehow about them should consider that possibility, that there's a continuum of behavior. And my own story of becoming a man and being poisoned by toxic masculinity is influenced by my own belief and experience that a real man is, in this culture anyway, and some of you have grown up in other cultures, so we can have that conversation too, but in this culture, men are supposed to be outwardly successful, confident, aggressive, and tough. And even with a family of origin that didn't particularly strongly drive that message, even with a father who was soft-spoken and shy in the context of being successful in a corporate career, I think you just get this training by drinking the water of our popular culture. Maybe we could call it the Kool-Aid of our popular culture in the context of that long ago story about poisoning and via Kool-Aid. It tastes sweet, but it does you harm. The one thing I remember vividly about my own social upbringing and personality was that I was always described in my family as having a temper. That is, I was a kid that would express reactive anger easily. I was the oldest of four siblings, so I learned early that my reactive anger, first when I was the only child, would not get ignored and dismissed. Instead, it usually got me what I wanted. And I enjoyed the benefits of that understanding early on and continued to get what I wanted in my family and from my siblings. And I've struggled in as an adult with the unhappy consequences of that kind of behavior. I've learned that ignorance and clumsiness about anger, why it arises, how to handle it, where to put it, is a very common problem among men, and it's a significant dynamic in toxic masculinity. So for me, anger can often be my response to feeling frustrated about a goal that I want to achieve, or frustrated about my own convenience, or my own self-image, especially if I feel shame. My go-to, I cover it over with anger. In many of these situations, I learned that I could weaponize anger to get what I wanted or just to make myself feel better. Anger is not an evil or unworthy emotion in and of itself. But like anything else that gets hot and that can cause harm, it needs to be handled skillfully. So there is a direct line between clumsy and ignorant management of male anger or rage and behavior that becomes unethical or criminal. And it is a very hard lesson that many men have yet to learn. Through the actions of brave women, women I've been married to, women I've supervised in church settings, friends, and even my own daughter, all of whom have been willing to give me feedback and call me on my behavior, I've learned about the poisonous short-term and long-term consequences of my own toxic behavior. I've learned more about how ways that I can use sarcasm, judgments, and intellectual defensiveness bundled with anger can all be means of exercising power to get what I want. And I've learned to recognize more quickly when I'm doing that. And I've learned that I often don't catch it fast enough. So at least I am figuring out how to back up and change my tone and direction more often in time to rescue a conversation or an interaction from doing long-term harm. So it still happens, but as we go deeper and deeper into toxic masculine behavior that crosses the line into violence and abuse, I understand ever more deeply how important it is to stop the seeds of that behavior from growing into something worse. So it's a process. It's climbing Jacob's ladder. It's a spiral. You learn new things as you go around the circle time and time again. Let's sing verses 3 and 4 of Climbing Jacob's Ladder. Just stay seated.
If I stumble, will you help me? If I stumble, will you help me? If I stumble, will you help me? We are climbing on.
As Reverend Rand introduced me, I'm Christian Straubhart-Jones. I'm a relatively new member of the congregation. And where Reverend Nguyen was talking about what it means as a man to struggle with the legacy of toxic masculinity that we all face, especially Western men face, I'm going to talk about things that we can all do, every single person, men and women in our community and as individuals, to lessen the degree to which we participate and contribute to toxic masculine culture. You might have noticed I set up a board over here. I'm going to a couple times ask for people to give responses if they want. And I'm happy to also fill it up on my own, but please feel free to call them out when I. So let's take a second to discuss some of the things that we as a society often associate with quote unquote real masculinity. Like with the reading today, when we say to someone, you know, man up or something like that, what are some of the things that we tend to mean?
If we really want to learn more about this idea, we should all probably watch Fight Club.
Okay, yeah, so Fight Club. So fighting, yeah, is something that we associate with real masculinity, yeah.
Stature,
yeah. Even like musculature sometimes, like muscly, you know, is what it, you know. Okay.
Never wrong.
Never wrong. Yeah.
Never cry.
Yes, no crying. No directions.
Brave.
Oh, are we losing? Oh, thank you. Brave, someone said, I believe. Stoic. Yes, exactly. Not showing your emotions or not having any at all. Yeah. Leading. Mm-hmm. Leadership. That's a really good list. Oh, did I see another hand in the mic? No. Okay. Yeah. And so now that we've talked a little bit about sort of this definition of what it means in our society to quote unquote be a man, what are some of the things that some of the names and labels that are given to people who fail to live up to this expectation, especially men and boys who aren't these things? What do people call them? And, you know, in church-appropriate things, of course.
Normally, they're called things like wimps.
Wimp, yeah.
Girl.
Girl, mm-hmm. Weak. Mama's boy, yeah. Yeah, wussy. Yeah, teacher's pet. Sorry about my handwriting. No backbone, yeah. Did teacher's pet already? Gay. Chicken. Coward, yep. We didn't have, no, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so already we begin to see some really troubling patterns here. One of the biggest ones that you notice right away is that there's a lot of misogyny in this configuration, that misogyny is feeling that women are somehow lesser or not as good as men. And sometimes even actively sort of being adversarial and that mean to women in more extreme forms. And this kind of configuration of what people say about ideal masculinity versus people who don't live up to that ideal is often referred to as gender policing. That this is a way that there is a right definition of what it means to be a man, and people who don't live up to that definition, according to the person doing it, are policed, are belittled or shamed in such a way so that they feel like they have to try harder to live up to this ideal. And we see the most striking examples of gender policing, of course, against gay men and transgender men, but it's something that every man in his life at some time or another has experienced, even whether he's recognized it as such or not. And it's not only unfair because of the fact that there are men for whom this definition of masculinity is never going to be a good fit, but it's also because it twists and warps what are some good qualities, bravery, leadership, often into really unhealthy ones. So, for example, this definition of manhood often focuses on being in control. And of course, it's good to be in control of your own life. But when that control comes through as dominance over others through aggression or violence, that's not healthy, and that's not something that should be celebrated. Similarly, this kind of masculinity values strength. But is it good strength if it needs to be proven through acts of recklessness or of cruelty, which we often see men do as a way to prove their strength? I'm so strong, I can lift this whole heavy, and they end up hurting themselves half the time. That kind of thing. Or emotional restraint can be good and is necessary in many situations, but can become a trap if a man feels like there is no place and no way that is ever appropriate for him to be able to express his emotions. And it's a burden that both the man himself and everyone around him ends up bearing. So this exercise kind of helps us see how simple, often seemingly harmless terms or good values can come together into something that's really unhealthy and really toxic. This system encourages men to not seek emotional support when they need it, to not know how to deal with their emotions generally, and after years and years of reinforcement, it can lead to terrible lashing out and toxic actions by those that are trained to think that control, power, and even violence are necessary for them to prove their own masculinity. It also helps us realize that in small, simple ways, and often without realizing it, we all contribute to this system. I had a friend who was a new mother come lament she was looking at onesies for her baby boy, and there were things like, cowboys don't cry. It's a baby. It's gonna cry. That's how it works. But this culture, these messages, these things hidden in jokes, things like that, become so pervasive that we might laugh and not even think about the underlying current that, say, some young boy will see that and think, oh no, I have to not cry. I have to never show my emotions. And when no alternatives to this sort of matrix are presented, it becomes a trap that many men never escape from and never feel like they can escape from, this very small, restrictive box that they have to live in all the time. And I strongly believe that each of us in our daily lives can either choose to reinforce this sort of framework around what it means to be a man, or we can deconstruct it in both big ways and also very small ways, in the words that we choose, in the stories that we tell, in the men that we praise and the men we choose to express our disappointment in. And there are a million ways that we can choose to reject or reshape the cultural narratives about what it means to be a quote-unquote real man, so that the men we know will see that there are alternative ways to think about masculinity and that they can trust us not to judge them for the ways that they may not fit and maybe begin to open themselves up a little bit more emotionally. One of the things that's hard about moving away from this configuration is that it takes a lot of emotional and mental work, and it takes a lot of practice. And so here are a couple of just small suggestions on places to start, which are from my wife, most of them. They're very good suggestions. So one of the big ones is to pay attention to media messages that you and your loved ones receive in movies, books, TV, about masculinity, and talk through them together to examine which narratives you think are helpful and which ones aren't. Especially notice when male characters are not listening to others, feeling like they have to go it alone all the time, and not paying attention to the agreement and the consent of others in the story. Encourage the men and boys in your life to foster emotional depth and authenticity, to work on the difficult skills of empathy, compassion, active listening, and service to others. Young men especially need to think deeply about consent and how mutual, enthusiastic consent is core not only to good romantic relationships, but to every kind of relationship we are ever in. And number three, seek open-hearted platonic relationships with men that share emotional honesty, especially ones who are of different ages or situations from you. This is especially important for men to establish strong, genuine friendships with other men, because our culture often teaches men that they're not supposed to be emotionally open and vulnerable with other men. If you are a man, seek a spiritual practice that brings self-awareness and centeredness. Help especially young men find these kinds of practices as they're looking for their spiritual paths. Many men don't explore their own emotional depths, and they end up requiring the women and the other people in their lives to do that emotional work for them. And then fifth and last, in the public sphere, lend active support to leaders from varied backgrounds in terms of gender, race, class, ability, and more. And part of why I suggest these things is that many, many men in our society carry a lot of secret hurt from this policing and these messages, hurt that they feel like they can't express and they can't let go of, no matter where they go, no matter who they're with. And that hurt is often the biggest thing that will drive them to hurt people around them and to do horrible, toxic things. And I know in my heart that if we can find ways to undermine and question this repressive matrix of ideas about what it means to be a man, we can create a more loving and just society for everyone. If we can take a good hard look at what we mean when we tell people to be a man, I know that we can make being a man more about emotional honesty and compassion and love. Thank you.